Good evening. I'm Mel Fabregas. Tonight, I have an encore presentation for you so I can spend the holidays with my family. We've all heard of Bitcoin. 4 years ago, I conducted an interview with Cliff High. Cliff was very excited about Bitcoin and even gifted me my first Satoshi so I could start the journey, the Bitcoin journey, back in 2013. Many people, including me, thought Bitcoin was just a trend that would be short-lived. It would fade away, like a flavor of the month. At the time we recorded our interview, December 2013, the price of a Bitcoin was about $200. As of December 2017, 4 years later, the price is almost $18,000. That's almost a 9,000% increase. Some say Bitcoin needs to be worth $1 million to be a legitimate currency. According to John McAfee, Bitcoin is headed to $1 million by the end of 2020. A couple of personal observations. Central banks are becoming very concerned. The jump in value is organic due to the limited amount of Bitcoins, or it could also be orchestrated for a possible crash. It could be bait in order to acclimate the population to digital currency. Regardless, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are here to stay. And anything that competes with the central banks is good enough for me. We dedicated a lot of time to Bitcoin during that time. Well, Cliff was right. When you listen to this interview, you may think he's referring to today's events, not 4 years ago. That's why I chose this episode tonight. As they say, hindsight is 2020. I hope that you can listen with a fresh set of ears. And before we proceed with tonight's interview, I wanted to remind you that you can now send comments and questions to me with your own voice. Just go to the member section and you will see the link right there. I will be accumulating a number of your messages and will air a future episode addressing your comments and questions. So let me share a couple of these messages with you tonight. Here's the first one.
Hello, Mel. This is George Cunningham. I just recently resubscribed. I just wanted to send you a message. I enjoyed the interview with Neil Kramer, and I liked the additional third segment that you included. I think it's a great idea to help disseminate information. I really appreciated the third segment. It was very informative information, and Veritas has been a part of my truth journey for a long time, so I hope you'll continue the new ideas and the new option that you mentioned, and I hope to continue listening to your interviews. Thank you for your work.
Hi, George, and thank you. Glad you enjoyed the interview with Neil. And yes, I will continue adding additional segments with extra audio to complement future interviews every so often. So I agree with you. Thank you. And here's another one which happens to coincidentally discuss tonight's interview.
Hi, Mel. This is Fernando Yañez from Uruapan, Michoacán, Mexico. And I want to say hi to all of the Veritas family out there. I've been listening Veritas Radio since 2010, and I can tell you that I have learned way much more in the past 8 years than in my entire school years. And also, I want to point out that besides all the knowledge that I have gained with the Veritas show, I got to hear for the first time in my life about Bitcoin in your program through Cliff High. This guy is amazing. And if I can choose one of the most brilliant minds of the 21st century in this planet, definitely it would be Cliff. Thank you for your knowledge, Cliff. By the way, please make a full show talking about all cryptocurrencies. Cliff would be a great guest. People need to know about this subject because if we learn how to control our own money, we can start taking power out of the powers that want to be, and together we can turn around this worldwide mess that we're living in. Thank you, and have a great holidays.
And thank you for those kind words, Fernando from Uruapan, Michoacán, Mexico. Maybe you need to connect with Vic Giza, who also lives in Michoacán, I believe about an hour and a half from you in Morelia. And like you, I've also learned more in the years I've been doing this program than all the years prior. So we're all learning together. Well, I received your message after I already had planned to air tonight's interview. So it was a coincidence that you mentioned Bitcoin. And what a great idea, a full show about all the cryptocurrencies. As you all know, Bitcoin is just one. So yes, once Cliff's situation improves, I will approach him to do a full show on this. And one thing I like to let everybody know about cryptocurrencies is that I don't have to worry about my money being rejected because it could be counterfeit. When you transfer bitcoins to someone, you don't hand over a bitcoin. You submit a transaction to the network. The network then makes sure your address is valid and has the proper value. So there's no risk of counterfeiting because there's nothing to counterfeit. Anyway, enough of this. Just wanted to show a couple of the messages. So I hope that you can contact me with your comments and questions and I'll display them in a full show, or maybe I'll add one or two every so often. So thanks to George and Fernando. I also want to take this opportunity to wish you a happy holiday season. Merry Christmas if you celebrate it. And a happy, healthy, and prosperous new year. Now, enjoy the interview. Tonight's special guest is a very good friend of Veritas and joins us this very special fifth anniversary. I'm referring to the creator of Internet Prophetic Computer Program that predicts or forecasts future events on a global scale via an asymmetric trend analysis report, commonly known by us as the Webbot. You can learn more about Cliff High and purchase his reports by visiting his website at halfpasthuman.com. And to discuss trends for 2014, I would like to welcome Cliff High back to Veritas. Hello, Cliff, and thank you for being with us on our five-year anniversary.
Yes, congratulations, and thank you for inviting me. It's very cool.
Thank you very much. And as you were telling me, you are being sprayed. There's so much to discuss today, but I'm going to start with something that a lot of people are seeing more and more, chemtrails. You're seeing that a lot, and it's affecting you health-wise, isn't it?
Yes, there's absolutely no question about it. It's been a constant battle as the rate of the spraying increases to maintain a positive health in the environment. Specifically, I suffer from most from sinus problems, but also maybe starting to suffer from joint issues as a result of the heavy exposure to the crud in the chemtrails, strontium, barium, aluminum, and so on. The aluminum is also very worrying because of its impact on the brain, being very tightly associated with the onset of Alzheimer's. So it's been a real struggle. My response has been over the years, first off, it's incremental. So the first time I got a sinus headache, for instance, no connection whatsoever, as far as I knew, in my mind to the chemtrails. At that point, I think I was actually unaware of chemtrails, at all. This was probably 94 or so. And never had a sinus headache or anything close to it, thought it was a migraine. And then over the years, it finally dawns on me, you know, as the chemtrail levels increase and the number of and frequency and intensity of the sinus headaches increase, aha, maybe there's a connection here. And sure enough, you can plot it one for one, that I get these terrible headaches. And I've also gone to the trouble of going out at night with the third generation night vision goggles on nights of heavy spraying. And you can see the material coming out of the chemtrails as an electrostatically sensitive, that is to say, it is picked up by the mechanism of the third generation night vision goggles, and it displays it as sort of a fog. And you take the goggles off and there's no fog whatsoever. This can be any kind of atmospheric conditions, and you'll find this is the case. Whether it's extremely cold and you may have a fog form off the ground, that sort of a hoarfrost fog, or whether it's in the middle of summer. And you get these giant what I call electro fogs, that come rolling down out of the sky. And they're quasi-cohesive. It seems to hold together. It doesn't want to disperse once it's on the ground. And little puffs of wind blow it all around. And then you'll realize, I'm breathing, eating, and living in that. And this ain't good.
Absolutely. Aluminum associated with Alzheimer's, barium associated with heart conditions, depletes the body of potassium, strontium, radioactive, and causes cancer. And I know somebody who's very high up in one of the major airlines, and I asked him the question the other day because he sees them where he is, and he said, it's not us. It's not the commercial airliners. It's a military or somebody else, because they fly at a much higher altitude, about 60,000 feet. But do you think this is for geoengineering
or is it for eugenics?
There's a real question about that. First off, I know that the chemtrail guys do fly at a higher altitude, and we have proof of this because over the last 20 years, they've forced the commercial flights to fly lower. And it's had a direct impact on the cost of their fuel, because the lower they fly, the denser the air.
Right.
And thus, the more fuel they use. They used to love to fly in the 40 to 50,000 foot range, and now they're being even restricted into there and forced down lower. And a lot of them are wondering why. And it has to do, I think, with the atmospheric alterations that the chemtrails are going on now, or are causing. Now, the issue of, is it geoengineering or eugenics? There's no reason to suggest that it's an either or proposition. I would think that geoengineering is a population killer, because if they change the planet to the point where it's acidic and suited for the, a green slime space alien crabs that are doing all this behind the scenes, then obviously humans won't be around. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think if it is geoengineering in that sense, then there will be a drastic effect on the human population as well as the other life. And we're seeing that right now. Large extinctions and die-offs. Now, this could be part of a natural extinction cycle, which occur in any event, and I think that that is a case that we're into one of those. But who knows what effect the geoengineering or the spraying of the chemtrails is having. If it were directly, I've often thought, well, if it's an assault on humans, that they want to pollute and kill humans, it's really a slow and stupid and uneconomical way to go about it. And so in that sense, I know the military mindset is basically would be expressed as the idea, oh, you want us to gas them? Sure, we'll gas them. They'll all be dead in 20 minutes. And then the politicians would say, no, 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 we want them dead in 50 years. And the military guys are going to say, no, that makes no sense at all. They wouldn't operate that way. So if it is someone that is attempting to do a slow poisoning in a very selective fashion, again, it's incredibly inefficient way to approach it. I mean, beyond any level of understanding.
I also often wonder, you know, how they dispose of fluoride. It is what I believe is derived from aluminum, and they
it's a steel process.
Steel waste process. Yeah. So they actually put it in the local water supply. I wonder if so many people are protesting about this that now they're taking aluminum instead of disposing it the right way. Why don't you spread it around, you know, cities to make people dumb and stupid and you know, create Alzheimer's and all sorts of disease?
I could buy the idea that they're using aluminum in an approach to dumb everybody down, but I don't see it as using it as a waste product, because they've got to go to some trouble to get this refined aluminum at that grade into the chemtrail mix. Bear in mind, aluminum is or bauxite is the second most prevalent ore we've got on the planet, but it's extremely hard to extract into and make into a metal that's useful, which is why aluminum is such a late arrival in our metallurgic history. Okay, it wasn't. We had humans start with stuff that's simple, and we work our way forward. So we started with tin, we started with copper and gold, easily malleable metals that we can locate and that had a tendency to clump together in nature. We then went on to the more denser metals of iron, et cetera, which would be slightly more dispersed, because ferrous metals have a tendency to rust out, and they're sort of a reddish soil as opposed to a copper vein that you might actually find. And so, or gold or silver, where you can actually find veins of the things running in rock. And so aluminum is even further down the chain there as a more sophisticated metal, because it's just built into the substrate of the whole planet, and you can just grind up basically. If you wanted to go to the trouble, you could probably dig deep enough or far enough on almost any place on the planet and find sufficient quantities of bauxite in order to make usable aluminum out of it. But it's a very sophisticated process that's very high in energy. And then they take that aluminum and then they further refine it to get it to the 5/9 grade pure that they're dumping out of the airplanes. It's not waste aluminum that's up there. This is a microparticle aluminum that after the huge electrical cost of zapping the bauxite and creating it and pouring it into aluminum, they then had to take this aluminum and refine it even further with an even more cost. So it's not disposal of a waste product. With the case of fluoride, you had a huge mountains of the stuff piling up in the east as a result of the steel industry producing it. And one of the apocryphal tales is that, you know, they said, aha, we've got so much of this, why don't we just let the people eat it?
And right.
That's when they started shoveling it at us. It's not the same case with chemtrails, this highly sophisticated level of engineering, as we see by their dispersal. They started off and they've grown their ability to disperse multiple kinds of chemtrails. They've got them on stop and start action now, so they can make little puffy clouds. Whereas before, it was initially these rainbow oily smears. I haven't seen those for years. I used to actually be able to sit here on my back deck and take photographs of large rainbow effect oil-based clouds floating overhead and see them and take photos with my digital camera because they were casting rainbows in that cloud itself. And it would just float on by. Strangest thing you've ever seen. And it was not a generalized rainbow or any of this. And it was really related directly to the chemtrails. And I think to the crude level of the process at the time. And we just don't see those anymore at all. Now we see this extremely effective gray slime that can, you know, four planes. And you've got 2 hours later, you've got gray slime in an area 60 miles by 120, which is basically what they do for Puget Sound. Is they smear us with this slime and then they spray continuously and it blows to the east. Now, at first I thought today, oh, they're attempting to make snow here, but the type of chemtrails they're spraying at the moment, I doubt that's the case. I think that whatever they're doing at the moment is going to be is designed to have an impact further inland as the winds come up later tonight and into tomorrow.
And this is my last thought on chemtrails. I will move because we have so many other topics. But, you know, I wonder how much influence they have over the Weather Service, because sometimes I see they report for tomorrow. Oh, it's going to be cloudy. And I wake up in the morning and I see the planes, no real clouds in the whole day. And after they spray for a couple of hours, the entire city is clouded. So what influence do they have on the Weather Service to report that it's going to be cloudy, but it's based on the chemtrails?
They own the Weather Service.
Yeah.
I mean, the individuals that may protest are quickly eliminated and gotten out of there. It is estimated that there's 3 CIA employees working in every single radio and TV station in every single one of the major markets, and maybe even down into the second tier, which would be the top 55 cities in the United States. If that were the case, in some of these stations, that would mean that one third of the staff was working for the government surreptitiously. And I have no doubt of that at all. That indeed there are agency controls placed on the media at all levels, and they report troublemakers, and you know they can be very easily dealt with the mechanics of the society that we have at the moment. They don't have to take anybody out and shoot them for questioning this kind of thing. They're just reassigned, or you know they get a bad review and they're fired. You know, it's a very iffy business to begin with. You're never really sure what's happening. You know, entertainment per se is a probably one of the riskier businesses around in terms of just the flavor of the month kind of a deal. So, and people are fired just because their hair doesn't look right. And so is that the case, or were they asking the wrong questions of the wrong people?
And this brings me back to Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda. You know, you see news right now being read from a script. You can change channels at the same time, and it's pretty much word by word the same thing. The same thing's happening in schools now. Teachers are reporting that Common Core is taking individuality from the classroom. Do you see this standardizing of everything in the future?
No. Actually, this is the last gasp of the dying old order, and it's not going to be effective. We're not going to go into a dark 1984 THX1138 kind of vision of the future. It's not going to be that regulated, and it's not going to be that controlled. In fact, it will be the exact opposite of that from the viewpoint of the unenlightened individuals. We're going to go into a period of chaos for a number of years, perhaps 2, 3, 4 generations. Could be hard to say. The effects are going to be felt in different ways, and the chaos is going to arise from different sources. So, for instance, we won't go the way the control freaks want us to go, because the heavy-handedness with which they're operating. The fact that they've taken the velvet glove off and they're smacking people around and shooting the dogs and shooting people just on the intimidation factor is a sure sign that the state has lost its legitimacy. There is no longer any acquiescence on the part of the populace to say, oh, hi, Mr. Policeman, here, let me buy you a donut and coffee. It's so cool having you patrol my street. These days, the police are seen as the enemy. This is a sure sign that the statists are losing their power in terms of their ability to control the mind. And through that, I mean, their propaganda has failed. You can use propaganda for tremendous gains to a certain point. And it's one of these, you know, you can't fool all the people all the time kind of a thing. Propaganda wears off. Conditions change, but the propaganda doesn't. And that's why it becomes glaringly obvious. So conditions change, and one day you happen to tune from one station to the next, to the next, to the next, and it's all the same script, and it suddenly dawns on you, why isn't the news different from one station to the next? Why is my local guy telling me the exact same thing that the national guy just did? Why it's, you know, they want me to repeat this over and over and over again. And eventually, it starts wearing off on larger segments of the population. It becomes self-reinforcing, and we're at that point right now. Further, there are other more key issues that will force the statist, and in fact are already forcing the statist, to take that velvet glove off, to become very, very aggressive, and that is the sure sign of their failure. As Gandhi observes, you know, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, and then they fight you, and then you win.
That's right.
Well, we're at the state where they're fighting us. Now, if we're really smart, we won't fight back the way they expect, and they'll collapse.
What about I'm just thinking of Andy of Mayberry and how different it looks now. The 1.6 billion bullets that are supposedly going to be purchased in the next 5 years, equivalent of 105 years worth of purchases, the close to 3,000 armored cars for DHS.
Yeah,
what's your take on that?
Okay, let's stop and say right there that that's fear-mongering, that simply repeating those numbers without also stating 5 years, how the absolute, friggin' hell are they going to pay for it? They can't. They can't buy anything these days. Our military is crumbling now. The United States Empire is crumbling now. The Western Empire is crumbling now because of currency debasement that is so egregious that the system is coming unglued. And if anyone projects now that they're going to buy X number of millions of bullets over the next 5 years, I would say that's a very nice projection. Now, tell me how you're actually going to come up with the money 3 quarters from now to pay for that amount that you're going to purchase then. And then I might give you some credence that you could project out a year. But I doubt it seriously. All of the here's the bind that the statists are in. And it doesn't matter what country you're in. To some extent, it's true in all countries that are dominated by a central bank. There are some countries it's less true, and that would be China and Russia and some of the Asian countries and India. But in most of the countries around here, the statists are now in this really interesting problem. Okay, and I'll describe it very graphically just so that you get an idea of it. The statists are pursuing a policy that they have for the last 45 years in the propaganda, which started the whole conversation here, of distorting economic numbers to control the mindset of the population. This is all well and good. They start off, they say, hey, Dow is rising. Look, look, look. You know, it's going to go over 10,000. Hooray, hooray. You know, all is good. I remember when, you know, Dow went over 1,000. And I also remember when everybody said at the end of the world, the Dow will be over 10,000. You know, as soon as we go over 10,000, the world ends in terms of the regular Wall Street kind of populace. But everybody got lulled into this sense of understanding that the status wanted through the propaganda. But their problem is that they themselves are suffering the effects of their own propaganda. So they create a mental worm that creates certain numbers, or that is based on certain numbers, that goes out into the populace. That mental worm causes effects within the populace that then feeds back into their system, and their system is using some of these feedbacks in order to generate these bogus numbers to begin with. And so it becomes very subtle over time, but it becomes very magnified over time as well, especially in these latter days that we're in now, where the effect of their bogus numbers generated 5 years ago is coming back to bite them in the butt now. And none of the things they are doing will work. None of their projections will pan out because they're based on basically eating their own mind worms data and regurgitating it in an altered fashion. And then 2 years later, re-eating that same data, which has already been altered and distorted, and further distorting it is such that even the statist, especially the statists, have no real accurate understanding of what's going on any of the inputs for any of their models, because the data is coming in and then it's coming in a distorted fashion, and it's been distorted for about 45 years now. Thus, they find themselves in a situation where even if they know they're lying, even if they know that they won't be able to buy the bullets 5 years from now, they don't know, or even 2 years from now, they don't know by how much they're lying. They have not got a clue. I know this to be a fact because I've worked at state government and seen the effect up close and personal and participated in it. And then years later, understood what my participation actually caused and what was going on. We were actually in a situation in a state government agency that fed the federal government numbers that they used in their quarterly calculations from Washington State for economic and other money allocation purposes and so on. We were in the position of sitting down in a large committee, basically, and all colluding to lie on specific numbers to generate a specific response from the giant federal beast that thus would then feed us down at our lower level. Never mind that we were not providing the federal beast anything close to realistic numbers upon which to base its allocation process or the whole collection process or any of it. It was not even a consideration and was never brought up in the process of creating these numbers that were then forwarded up chain. Now, I'm sure the feds do the same at every single part of their up chain. But do they ever question, is this being done to us down chain?
That's right.
So they don't know. So if they say, oh, we're going to buy 3,000 tanks, they can't even tell me where they're going to be getting the steel from for those tanks 3 years from now because their numbers are so screwed.
It seems that they're, as you say, fear-mongering to keep the population wondering. But now we're getting to the financial aspect of the interview. You know, I read a lot of stuff this morning to prepare. Here's one, ditching the dollar. Canadian province issues $2.5 billion in Chinese yuan bonds. Isn't this a clear warning to everyone, as you've seen?
The clearest warning was the Chinese government the other day, I think last week, coming out and saying it's not in our interest to accumulate further Western debt. Basically, they're saying we're not going to be buying any dollars anymore. That also, there's a hidden subtext to that, which means we're getting rid of the ones we got. So, yes, this pretty much has been a game changer. The problem is, Mel, that it's not going to be a line in the sand. It's not going to be an attack by another country on a specific day where you can say on this day of infamy, blah, blah, blah. This is going to be a change that the statist can't deal with. They could deal with that. If all of the populace that's really pissed, say that 3% of the global populace is pissed at all the lies and the distortions and the corruption of the statist. And the statist in their vast numbers only numbered a quarter of a tenth of a percent. So we outnumber them in huge levels, and most of the populace is sheeple and isn't going to do anything either way. We could all rise up and attack the statist and kill them all in a single day and be done with it. But the statist, that's their biggest fear. They know that that can occur. They know they're hugely outnumbered. They fight and prepare for that their entire mindset century after century after century. So it would be a sucker game for us to walk on in and attempt to do everything in a giant, global strike on a day that would lead to a global revolution or any of this. So it's nice that Russell Brand gets out there and has this egalitarian, sort of thing, in spite of the fact that he may be, mind controlled himself and be nothing more than loyal opposition, to bleed off some of the energy. But it's great that he's advocating revolution. But I'm here to tell you that, it's already happened. They've lost. We're seeing the signs that they've lost now. And it's simply a matter of us keeping on in the way in which we're doing to erode them all. So in this case, it's not going to be a a global day of insurrection. There may come a single day in which there are huge things that occur as a result of momentum building over this past decade. But it has been the advent of the alternatives to the currency wars that are going on between the central banks on a global fashion, a global scale, that has reached a critical mass and gone beyond a tipping point. And so instead of the edifice of the state being brought down by the mobs, it's much more like there's a giant leak in the basement and everything that's a resource is draining out. And one day we'll just walk by and give a big puff and it'll all fall down because it's draining out drip by drip by drip by drip out of so many leaks. They can't do anything about it. And we know the desperation in their voices rising that they've suddenly discovered that they can't do anything about the leaks. And now they're trying to fight us. And again, it's on the, you know, ignore you, ridicule you, and then fight you, and then you win. Well, they're really starting just to fight us at the economic level, so we know we're about ready to win.
You know, now we're talking about China, and there's so much about China that I'm seeing this morning. For example, I read that you've heard about the Catskill Mountains.
Yeah.
Have you read that?
Yeah, what a bogus. Again, here they're saying that 600 acres of land, like 600 acres is huge.
Right.
It's not. It's a relatively small area. You know, in Texas, that you know, that might be the area that you would keep around your outhouse. It's that small, right? But nonetheless, they're also saying that the United States populace is going to pay for 20% of that. I think not. The powers that be don't have the money to control the populace anymore, let alone gouge them for 20% of this city of the future thing. So again, you know, it's a fear mongering and it's a nice projection, but we're at a critical point and a shift in history where a lot of the stuff that's coming, anything coming out of media, especially that has any of the fear words attached to it, and especially those fear words that are targeted at specific demographics, racist demographics in the specific choice of the language that they use to, you know, discuss the Chinese, et cetera, right? And how it was going to be buy a green card or a visa kind of a deal to invest in it from the Chinese view perspective. Well, let me tell you, the Chinese are not really thrilled about coming over here anymore. This is a third world country to their way of thinking. And they would probably have to have a large Shanghai, you know, Singapore kind of a city to get them the inducement to come on over because they don't want to live with the barbarians. And I can't say that I blame them. But no, it's again, propaganda that if it's a projection beyond next year, forget about it. At the end of next year, 2014, you can say, okay, now we can make some projections that would have, you know, a 1 in 20th chance of being realistic. And the reason we'll be able to do that is because there will be so much, chaos emerging and so much of the quote order that has been imposed on us these last 45 years will erode over this next year.
And again, I'm looking at so much information coming from China. They're racing their one child policy to two children policy. How about those ghost cities? You know what I'm talking about? Building mm-hmm. after building, shopping centers. What do you know about that?
Well, there's a lot of speculation that was their response to a particular discussion that was originally brought up in 1937. Okay, in 1937, this economist looked at all the, as part of a study that Buckminster Fuller was also involved in at another level. He was looking at resources at a planet-wide level for ore and metals and stuff when this economist was looking at something else as part of this sort of global study that was done. It wasn't that coordinated. But in any event, this economist comes to the idea that the construction industry drives all countries that are operating on paper money into depression and kills the economy. And why is this? Well, because the construction industries are seen as so key, they're always subsidized, and that they always end up consuming huge amounts of resources in ways that are basically hidden and capital intensive. So, for instance, most people are unaware that cement is the worst possible building material we could ever use because of it's greatly energy intensive. And if we stopped using cement right now, we would reduce our energy consumption in the construction industry down by 9/10. 9/10. So if we burn 1 billion barrels of oil a year, we would reduce that down to 1/10 of that if we just stop using cement as a building material. Because of all the stuff we have to do to get cement. It's heavy, requires all this water, you got to burn rock to get it, and huge amounts of pollution and so on and so on.
Bring hemp back.
Exactly. Exactly. Hemp. Well, that's what Buckminster Fuller was working on, too, was a pressed paper and hemp fiber kind of a cement that didn't have a lot of the negative attributes, but had a lot of the positive attributes of cement. But as an aside, but in any event, so the Chinese find themselves in this particular particular quandary. As part of their growth in all countries, as part of the growth of the fiat currency run by the central banks, they pump vast quantities of debt into the production of housing and large construction projects. This is how, for instance, we got ourselves out of the last depression. Was not World War II, as many would suggest. That was an after effect of our overproduction. We actually had to throw away stuff out of our shores in order to get it to stop plugging up our supply chain, so to speak, right? And so that was what World War II was really all about. But the prior to that, we got ourselves out of the Depression with the militarization of our populace and these vast, huge construction projects, the dams, the roads, the Tennessee Valley Electrical Authority, all of this kind of thing. We could have just built ghost cities and would have had the same effect. It would have geared up a huge inflationary spiral that was related to the construction industry. So there was a article that was written by a Chinese economist, and I think it was in like the late 1980s, 89 or so, something like that, about data from 1952 on in China. And he made the suggestion at that time that one way we can always defeat the tendency for the construction industry to drive us into a depression is to isolate them, ring them in, find a desert somewhere and say, go over there and don't bug us. And basically keep building as long as it doesn't come into the situation of where you have to sell it. As in the United States, where we have 12 million empty houses, and yet they propose to build more, and they're going to have more of a problem selling those. In China, they've eliminated that as an issue at the moment by the way in which their central authority works. They don't have those things yet hitting the economy in a really negative fashion, the ghost cities, I mean. However, the two-child policy is a direct response to the 20-year impact that the construction industry is going to have as they keep building. And so they actually need population now. And then they also have another issue, which is the demographics of male to female ratio and when then specific demographics that are pointing to a potentially a huge problem of 200 plus million males with no possibility of ever getting wives. And this is going to really distort their social order in about another 11 years. And so they're kicking all this into high gear. And also now I think you'll start seeing the liberalization of all kinds of social contracts within China relative to China is a relatively conservative society. I think we'll see it liberalized just as a response to the needs of the huge testosterone pool they've created with their one-child policy.
Well, when you think about it, if they know currency is worthless, invest in construction and real estate for a rainy day and raise the birth rate from 1 to 2, it's great speculation.
Correct. And it actually makes a lot of sense under those circumstances. When they also observe, if you read Chinese literature, you find out what they're thinking about. And they really, to a certain extent, are arrogant in assuming that a lot of Westerners don't. That is to say, they assume a lot of Westerners don't read Chinese and don't pay attention. But they've been discussing such things as the dwindling birth rate of the Japanese and how it might be convenient 20 years from now to be able to take over Japan as their population will be so small relative to the Chinese need for more land, these kind of things. However, there's a couple of things. The idea that the Chinese would invade the United States en masse isn't really going to happen. Again, it's an economic issue, but also there's the social mindset of the Chinese. They used to do great things on the planet, and they sailed around and brought giraffes back from Africa to the Chinese emperor when the royals in Europe were still defecating in caves. that is how far advanced the Chinese were. They had huge, giant Chinese junks that had were so big you could play soccer at each end of the thing and not have the games interfere with each other. that kind of thing. And they sailed all over the planet. They came to the western United States. They came to the west coast of Asia. They intermingled with the local populations 1,500 years before Columbus. And so at that point, though, the Chinese themselves ran into an issue of their population reached a certain density level that required that more and more of the upper echelon devote more and more of their attention to control of the population, and they were thus less empirically minded simply because they had such a huge population. It would be the same situation here, that if we had a population 10 times our size, you would find none of the issues of our country meddling with anybody else's affairs because our elites would be too busy trying to keep their butts from ending up in a stew pot from pissing off the wrong people within our own population. And that's basically the Chinese situation. So they can be aggressive to a certain extent. They understand that they're going to have to rule the planet through the Chinese century, at least. They are actually smart enough to be planning how to do this in an organized fashion, but they're also sort of reluctant to be involved in any of the mess. And I think there will be a huge level of hands-off, and unless it becomes irritating to the Chinese themselves, they're going to be not as territorial as the invasive as the Western elites.
You know, I wonder why Christopher Columbus takes the credit for being the first one around this area. He just opened the route for Europe. But, you know, the Vikings and the Chinese were here. I've seen maps that preceded Columbus being around here from the Chinese. Why do you think they didn't leave a more conspicuous footprint?
They
before.
Did. They left huge footprints in the delta region of the Mississippi, extending nearly 1,000 miles into what we think of as the United States, but 1,000 miles wandering at the time by the river. So not 1,000 miles straight, but 1,000 river miles. There were stelae, steles, these carved obelisks left that had 3 and 4 languages on them. They were left with hieroglyphics, hieratic, and what we think of as Sumerian, cuneiform, and one other one, and I forget what it is. There were drawings and statuary in plenty of vast quantities of relics, all of which the Smithsonian has been able to propagandize and keep under control. It goes to the extent that there were, to my knowledge, 2 huge cave complexes that have been shut off in the Grand Canyon. Well, I know from a personal fact that this is the case, that there was something there, because I happen to have been in a situation where I was exposed to the naked blunt end of the propagandistic force at the time they were doing that in the early 60s. Maybe it was late 50s. No, it was early 60s. I'm so old, I have to stop and think for a second. Anyway, though, but so there were Egyptian artifacts there. There were also huge levels of carving in the walls of the Grand Canyon that was, you know, intelligent carving, not river carving. And then we go even further. We find, for instance, the whole of Australia in the south coast, there are caves filled with Egyptian artifacts. This goes to the extent that locals in Australia, misreading the situation, say, aha, the indigenous population, which they call the Aborigine, were so advanced 40,000 years ago that they sailed to Egypt, picked up all this stuff as tourist items, and hauled it back. Well, no, it didn't happen that way. The Egyptians sailed all over the planet and left artifacts in Americas long before the Chinese. And they also left artifacts all over Polynesia, and we can trace the design of the ships and the sails and everything from Egypt all the way around the planet, basically through the Polynesian influences. And I can get into the sail types and how the boat evolved and all of this. But that core, the Egyptians were sailing around, or what we think of as the Egyptians, the Pharaohic peoples, were sailing around probably about 800 years before the Chinese did, and had very extensive knowledge of Australia, the trade winds all the way through the Polynesias, Polynesian islands. They left records in Hawaii. All this stuff has been propagandized right out of existence, just like the elongated skulls and all the abos, the out-of-place artifacts, you know? Any of those out-of-place artifacts,
that's right.
if they pop up, officialdom comes down, you're met with an offer you cannot refuse one way or another, and off it goes, because it can't be allowed to disturb the mindset that allows the Zionistic central banking system to control us. because it is some kind of a proxy for something that is behind it. I do not for a minute believe that the evil that the banksters do ends there. The vibrations that come out of the suffering and so on is part of a larger plan that they are unaware of. I can get really spooky at that level and say that there's space aliens out there, pulling chains that in turn, give the Rockefellers their power and all of this kind of thing, and the Rothschilds. And at some level, we can actually track evidence back that suggests that is the case. So it's all part and parcel of the whole mess. You can't have an academic understanding that supports Christianity when there's so much to say that it never happened. You can't have an academic understanding that supports Columbus being the great discoverer of an empty a continent when there's so much evidence of, that the whites came over here and murdered 30 million indigenous population and took it over, and knowing that they were going to do that ahead of time, and that Columbus's participation was simply blown out of proportion as a PR stunt centuries later.
And Columbus might not have been Italian. He was a Sephardic Jew who was born in Catalonia. And because the persecution of the Inquisition at the time, he wanted to get to the New World, but saying that he was a Jew would not have cut it with the queen and the king. So that's why he changed the story. But as you say, out of place in time and space, the Antikythera mechanism and so many other things. I'm thinking of the Egyptologists, 95% of them are Muslim. So if you tell them that, no, the pyramids are thousands of years much more older than you think, they tell you that it's not the case. Why is that?
Well, they can't afford to have that at a personal level, because then it would break their belief system. And why do we legislate for belief systems? In any culture, if you go and look at the laws, you'll find that laws are concentrated in mind control. Taxes, that kind of thing. But also the other huge aspect of laws is all about belief systems. It used to be in the United States, we had open laws supporting belief systems, especially in the South, where they said, it's our belief system that blacks are inferior, therefore blacks can't drink from the same drinking fountain as whites, separate but equal. But, all of this kind of stuff, it was all cover up, because basically their Christian belief system structured there said blacks were unequal and couldn't be. And when they had laws to enforce this and make it legal. As everybody keeps pointing out, and we need to say it again, everything that Hitler did was legal. Everything Obama does is legal. Everything that Jamie Dimon, the great rapist of the financial system, does is legal. So laws and the authority, not necessarily moral or even effective.
So going back to China for a moment, the Senkaku Islands, what do you think is happening there? Are they showing some of their military might?
They have to. There's going to have to be a confrontation at that level, simply because our empire is dying. And as I say, the gloves are coming off. And if the Chinese kowtow, which is a Chinese word, to the Western people one more time, that will extend the situation further into the future. And they don't have to anymore. They know that a single day they could bring down our economic system without even having to fire a shot, just by effective propaganda on their own. They know that it's crumbling without their work having to do anything. And so they're just sort of content to sit back and let it happen. But they're always going to be aggressively defensive in what they perceive as their national interests. And one of the things, of course, that's underneath these islands, especially all over Japan, where the new volcanoes and everything are popping up, is energy, geothermal, as well as oil, natural gas, and so on. So there's a underlying, if you'll note, we're at a key inflection point in history. Every single continent is undergoing some kind of an energy rush at the moment. In Russia, they chose to do deep well drilling, and they started years and years ago, and they went really deep and they perfected it. Over here, the Western powers chose to be shallow, as their thinking is always shallow and is not deep and doesn't extend into the future. And so they decided to do fracking, okay, very shallow wells that try and force out lots of oil in the surface, as opposed to deep wells that would go down to a source. And so fracking, they also has a side benefit for the Western powers in that it requires lots of people temporarily. But it's a short-lived solution. Extremely short-lived, and it's a sign of a key inflection point. And here's where we're at. We've proven that peak oil exists and that peak oil occurred in 2005. So let's assume, just because it's easy to think about it in terms of these numbers, that there was two trillion barrels of oil on the planet. And we've gotten out 1 trillion barrels of oil so far in our 200-plus year history of mucking about with this stuff. And we picked all the easy fruit hanging on the tree. Now, if we want to get any other of the oil, we've got to work for it. Here's our problem, though. At this moment, the amount of notional and claimed debt on the planet is such that if we took all of the rest of the oil on the planet, the other trillion barrels of oil, they're going to be harder and harder and harder and more expensive to get and produce less and less actual usable energy as an end result. If we took all of those and they were basically given to us free without us having to put any energy into getting those other trillion barrels of oil, we still could not burn that oil in a manner that would be productive enough to be able to earn enough to pay off the debt that we've got right now. And debt grows year after year after year. In fact, it's getting into a situation where it's basically starting to get to near doubling or reaching an exponential growth period over the course of a single year. So peak oil is reached at the same time that we have peak debt, in a sense. And peak debt trumps. No matter how much oil we pump, it's downhill from here, guys. We'll never be able to work our way out of the Zionist debt monster, that debtberg that they've created. It's all under the surface, and when it starts rising, it's going to swamp out all of the currencies and destroy the financial system. Now, that doesn't matter. The financial system needs to go. It's I wanted to bring up the subject anyway, but there's this person out there who's a whistleblower for the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Now, bear in mind that none of these labels are accurate, okay? The International Monetary Fund should actually have a label that says interest rate apartheid rapers of third world countries.
A good one.
And decimators of their population, because that's what they do. Their whole purpose is to get countries in debt so that they can sell off the proceeds to their buddies back in the Western world, kick off the indigenous population or kill them if they get in the way, such that these guys can have a nicer life with the resources that this debt produced.
Neo-feudalism.
No, not even that. It's worse than neo-feudalism, because in feudalism, there was actually an incentive for the feudal lord to keep a certain level of population going just to support his lifestyle. Now it's the other way around. It's the economics of extinction. So, for instance, in the economics of extinction, it makes sense for a factory trawler to go on out and harvest as many tuna as they can now, even knowing that they're going to bring the extinction of the tuna 5 years earlier, and they're harvesting them and freezing them, waiting for that extinction to when they can then raise the price up to vast levels beyond understanding and recoup all of the money in the 5 years of freezing them. That's actually ongoing at this moment, is this economics of extinction. And so the economics of extinction are also applying at the real estate level for things like the elites and the Bush clan buying all of the water in Paraguay, that kind of thing. It's like, okay, guys, you know, you all go and drink it. I'm sure the locals will let you once all this breaks down. But anyway, getting back to my point here, there's this woman who's a whistleblower for the IMF. And it's great that she's a whistleblower, and I applaud her efforts on talking about the corruption and everything at the IMF, but she's coming at it from a wrong perspective. The IMF is not an organization that needs to be whistleblown. It is a criminal gang. And so it's not like you need a whistleblower to drop out of the mafia and tell you that the mafia is bad.
Talking about Karen Hewitt, the World Bank whistleblower?
Exactly. Okay. So, yes. But she's doing a lot of disservice, actually, because she's coming up with the hidden subtext, or the not so hidden subtext, is we've got to work to reform this organization and save the dollar. And it's like, huh? Non sequitur here. That does not compute. We don't want the dollar saved, because that's the source of power for the oppressors that are killing us off individually and in mass. That's the source of power for the police state. That's the source of power for the Zionist bankers attempting to take over the Muslim world. That's the source of all of the evil on this planet, is the currencies, is the fiat currencies. Not just the dollar, but everything that's pegged to the dollar. You know, the fiat currencies of Canada, Britain, Australia, and so on and so on. And so the fiat currencies are their source of power. So why should we work our butts off to reform an organization that is criminal to begin with and can't truly be reformed in that sense. Its mission statement is never, was never as stated, just like with the UN. And thus we get into a situation of where I think she's bleeding off, you know, well-intentioned or disinformation is not my call. But nonetheless, she's bleeding off in an area that should not be followed. We should not attempt to save the dollar. We shouldn't give a rat's ass about the dollar. And in fact, we should all clap our hands and say, what can I do to get my ass out of the dollar? Because I just heard today that Larry Summers has had a big conference speech in which he laid out the plan for how they can legitimately come along and level service fees against your savings account. And what are they going to do? They're going to tax you for not spending your money. Why, you evil saver, if you save money, you're not helping the economy and the government, which needs that money in circulation to maintain control over your mind and that of the people around you. So if you don't spend that money, why, the government's just going to have to take it from you at the rate of 47% each and every year of whatever you happen to have in your savings account at some date that they will not announce in the future, but will tell you after they've done it. And this will be your incentive to spend, and buy more cheap crap from China. Well, China isn't buying this. They know that that isn't occurring. The whole idea of a trade city in the East Coast is fear-mongering on somebody's part because the impetus there doesn't exist anymore, and the Chinese are well aware of that. In fact, if you look at all of the Chinese internal documents that are coming out, you'll see that there's been a linguistic trend towards internal focus that is significant over like the last 15 years.
You know, you mentioned Larry Summers, but how about Janet Yellen, the upcoming Fed chairman coming in January? She advocates to have negative interest rates. Isn't this, I can't say legalized, but a more legalized way of confiscating funds in a different way than what we saw in Cyprus?
No, it's part and parcel of the same process. It's what required the activity in Cyprus. Zero interest rates are deflationary. Zero interest rates are zero interest rates to our friends. Let Mel or Cliff or anybody we know go to a bank and say, could y'all give me $1 million on zero interest rates so I can go and speculate in the stock market and see what you get,
sure,
right? Okay, it's not going to happen. So the zero interest rate business is a misnomer, and you have to look at the language and what they're actually saying. And Yellen, first off, is an extremely stupid woman. I mean, this woman is dumb. And they chose her for a lot of different reasons. And one of them is to be the patsy during these last few years of the dollar. And also because she's very predictable because she's dumb. And she always basically does the last thing that's said in meetings.
And this is confirmed by some of her classmates. They can't believe she went this far.
Oh, yeah. Stupid beyond understanding, but, you know, easily led, corrupt at her soul. We won't go into, you know, any kind of sexual blackmail they're using over her because I don't know that they need to. She's probably so dumb it doesn't matter. So in any event, though, the level of stupidity that she enjoys is such that she is blinded to the actions of her language. She thinks they're going to have a certain kind of a response, but doesn't understand how much she's revealing in what she actually says. And the other aspect of this is that she's being used. And so you have to look at everything that she does as a slightly obscuring steam on the window you need to get off to see what's really going on back there. And they would not choose Yellen in 1987, at the time of that crisis, because they wanted the system to last. And so they chose Volcker, because Volcker was not stupid. Okay, Volcker may have been a lot of things, but he was not really dumb. Now, why do you choose as the head of your company a really dumb person? Well, because you need a patsy. And so, you know, they give patsies different names, and one of them might be Ken Lay from Enron, a really dumb guy who managed to make it all the way up to the point where he died the day he was supposed to go to jail. So it's kind of like, well, you know, the subtext there, what's going on in the background. I think Yellen was chosen because at this particular point in history, they needed a really stupid person to make some really egregious moves that were going to be used to obscure the things that are going to occur anyway. And they know that this is happening now. The issue for them has been rather startling, though, because see, here's the problem. The Zionistic bankers, quatre, the four-party rulers, it's not a triumvirate, it's a four-party. It's the military, it's the bankers, it's the politicians, and it's the media. and this cobble expected that the next assault that they would have to face in keeping their power would be felt and dealt with by the military, and that the gloves would come off, the population would rebel, and the military would beat the absolute crap out of us and kill as many as they possibly could and establish a police state that might last 150 years because of the total level of control that had been outlined in things like 1984 and other prophetic or forecasting literatures. And that was actually their plan. And then in 2009, things changed. And whether you say it was, you know, driven by, how do I want to say it, allegiances or whatever, for whatever reason, I say that universe, the vast collection of the totality and sum of all human experience, demanded that an alternative present itself at this time. And alternatives did present themselves. And one of the alternatives that has survived is Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, which are eroding the very soul of the power elite, which exists on that energy exchange that is within currency, and that they have been taxing and bleeding us through that for countless generations now, and it's going away. And the peer-to-peer nature of the cryptocurrencies and the new currencies that are arriving in this currency competition or war is going to be something that they can't control, that they're going to try everything they can do to disrupt and taint, and it's not going to work. And we've already won in that regard. We've crossed critical thresholds. And unfortunately for the power that be, we're not going to respond if we're smart in the way they want, which is large crowds of people on the street that they can beat with clubs and shoot with their guns. But I can tell you right now that 5 years on, they won't have dollars to buy bullets because the dollar won't be there to buy the bullets and no one will be accepting it. I won't be dealing in dollars next year.
It's interesting how I'm thinking of the next subject and you bring it up. So I'm glad that we have this flow. But I was reading a financial publication this morning and I see that the Central Bank of China has banned financial companies from Bitcoin transactions. And their excuse? They warn of danger currency is used for criminal activity. What do you think of that?
That's absurd too. Well, let's look at this too. That's their standard. What they're saying, let's look at what all the banks are saying. Bitcoin bad, fire bad, be scared. And that's what they're saying. They're saying, be scared of this, be scared of this. Because if you'll note, Bitcoin, in terms of its total market capitalization, is so small that we could not handle 1 day's worth of money laundering that goes through HSBC. We couldn't handle 25 minutes of money laundering that goes through Goldman Sachs, because the total amount of people involved in the Bitcoin network and everything is so small relative to the huge amount of corruption. So that's a huge spurious argument. There can't be any kind of criminal activity that is in a meaningful way associated with Bitcoin. And that's why they're pissed. They don't control it. They can't hide their crimes with it. They can't profit with it. And that's why they're pissed. And they're going to come on out and do all kinds of things. Like they're going to create their own fake cryptocurrencies and try and pollute the market. They're already doing that. We think one of the pump and dumps that they're using is called Quarkcoin. So I would advise people to be really intelligent if they get into the cryptocurrencies. Look to Bitcoin, look to its backbone model, the blockchain, and how that works. And if you don't see true peer-to-peer in a cryptocurrency, it may not be. It may be a pump-and-dump scheme, especially if there's 98% of the currency mined at the time you discover it. And it's, you know, quadrupling in value every third day. They're selling it to themselves back and forth to raise the price, and then they're going to dump it. And they hope to do this in order to taint the whole cryptocurrency market. Now, in my way of thinking, it was great news that China's central bank came out and said, oh, you can't deal in this, because now it actually points out the internal conflicts within the central organization of China themselves. There's a whole lot of companies in there that are in this situation, but let's just concentrate on one, which is Baidu, which is the Chinese version of Google. Every bit as big as Google, in fact, much larger than Google relative to the Chinese population and relative to the economics that provides. So Baidu is going to be the Google of the planet. and will destroy Google a little further down the road. But at the moment, Baidu accepts Bitcoin. And Baidu has some really tight connections in terms of its ownership to the central authority within the Chinese political structure. So what's going to happen there? You got one part of Chinese officialdom, the central bank, telling another part of the Chinese officialdom that it's going to do this or that or whatever. It's like, well, I read these things. Again, I assume that there's a certain propagandistic bias to it. They're obviously attempting to dissuade people from doing things with Bitcoin. It caused a momentary swoon in prices, which if I had any way of buying more, I would gladly take advantage of. But, you know, it happened so quick in the Bitcoin world that it just does. You can't really trade it. It doesn't really exist that way. But in any event, the Chinese central bank, it's like, hooray, hooray, yet one more central bank against Bitcoin. And this is good because Bitcoin does not need official acceptance. Official acceptance is a negative for Bitcoin to a certain extent, although Bitcoin is anti-fragile. It'll overcome all of this because it's basically not a currency alone the way that the central bankers would have you believe. There's, if you really stop and think about it and go back to the Satoshi Nakamoto original white paper, Bitcoin is two things, and they probably should have been named in two different ways. One is the protocol, the blockchain, which now is the largest single computing entity on the planet that we're aware of outside of the NSA. More computers are participating in the Bitcoin blockchain than any other activity. And it's growing exponentially, and that's its strength. But it's also a currency. So we can think of Bitcoin with a big B, which would be the blockchain. And then we can think of Bitcoin with a little B, which is the actual currency that floats across it. And so here the central bank is saying, well, you know, this is a bad, and they're trying to put a big B on it. But their ability to influence things other than with their words and the temporary price change is minimal. They can't short Bitcoin. You can't do a naked short on it and cause its price to fluctuate that way. If you had millions of them, which don't exist, you could sell them into the market, but then they're gone. And you can't repeat that because you can't infinitely create them the way they create paper gold, for instance, in the Western market. And they infinitely create paper gold and sell it in there to suppress the price of real gold. And the universe, the sum total of all human experience ever, says to itself, this ain't right. We need an alternative. And up pops Bitcoin just at the point where the institutionalized corruption is so severe that, sure, certain proof that cannot be argued as such is brought to the authorities of manipulation of the gold, the silver, the Forex, the LIBOR, and all other markets on the planet that the Western powers in any way engage in, are absolutely manipulated, and yet the authorities do nothing. They say, okay, that's fine. We know about that. Y'all go away. And at that point in the universe, it said, well, okay, you know, something's got a crack. And through that crack came a thought to our mythical buddy Satoshi, who wrote a white paper and then started mining coins. And everybody said, well, hey, I will freely accept this because the alternative is something I don't want to freely accept, and it's forced on me by these nasty people with guns. And so better I should take this course. And there's more of us doing that now every day than there are people that are willing to sit there and have this other stuff foisted on them by guns. The people with guns know this. The whole system is breaking down from their viewpoint. From my viewpoint, the whole system is breaking open. We're having a huge explosion in terms of creativity with Bitcoin as a funding source. We're getting all different kinds of technologies to emerge. And it's the new electrics. And we're about to just bust loose as the old system is dying. So it's very much a situation of got all of us humans out here just scurrying around doing all kinds of really cool things, sort of watching out for the shadow of these dinosaurs as they're getting ready to fall over.
You've been talking about this for, gosh, years, and I have to tell you, it's finally catching my attention. And, you know, why is China all of a sudden banning it? And I think it's because I saw the news.
No. China, be careful of your language. Sorry, Mel. China didn't ban it. There's many companies there that are still using it in spite of the central bank saying that they can't use it and be taxed on it. It's only the central bank recently that said that.
Central banks. The reason why they're saying that, I think it's because the yuan finally passed the euro as the number two currency for trade, and they don't want any competition, right?
It's much more complicated than that, okay, because the Chinese are not a simple people. There's a subtext within the Chinese central authority that does not want the yuan as global reserve currency. They don't really want, in spite of the fact that it favors them at some level, they don't want the currency responsibility of people issuing bonds, you know, in their currency from other countries. It's happening. They're trying to control it, and they would prefer not to have their currency be the global reserve currency because it allows them much more freedom at an internal level. Once you become the global reserve currency, then actions done at an internal level have an immediate no barrier repercussion because it flows through your currency, so to speak, throughout the whole planet. Whereas if there is a barrier in the sense of a forex trading, your currency has to be traded for dollars before there can be any kind of an energetic ripple, then there is at least that level of a firewall. And that kind of thing adds to the freedom that you have in terms of the responsibilities of what you can do with your currency. Makes sense?
It does, and if it becomes a foreign reserve currency as the dollar or the euro, wouldn't that inflate it, and that way their exports would suffer?
That's a spurious argument proffered by most of the central bankers as to why there's an ongoing currency war attempting to debase currencies like mad.
Right.
And no, that is not the case. Actually, it strengthens their currency. It's kind of like, let me ask it you this way. In 1945, at the end of, or 47, at the end of World War II, the United States had 50% of the planet's resources in gold and money, and had the strongest currency on the planet. And yet we also had the strongest two decades of exports ever. So why did that occur if that argument is sound? If you need weak money to have strong exports, then why did the United States enjoy such an export boom in the 50s and 60s? True, you can argue it was the military and all of this and dollar dominance and so on. But nonetheless, the strong currency aided us during that period of time and was actually one of Larry Summers' frequent mantras. We need a strong dollar to maintain exports. Now, of course, everybody's saying, oh, no, you got to weaken your currency to get the export market. And so it's much more complex than that. And the idea of weakening the currency just deliberately for the export market especially no longer applies to China, because they've turned inward and they realize that their middle class has now reached a point where it can be nurtured into a self-sustaining internal demand pool, if you will.
And somebody told me the other day, as he was discussing Bitcoin, he said the dollar is backed by guns, planes, tanks, and sheeple willing to die to protect it. Do you agree with that statement?
It's easier than that. Dollar is backed by death.
Backed by death. Interesting.
It has never been backed by anything else.
That's right.
Once, you know, even the gold that we had was obtained at the death of the indigenous population of the various areas that we had to clear out in order to get the gold. You know, specifically the Apache and the Comanche and the Cherokee all had great resources that had to be shifted off. So just in the beginning of our treasury, getting the gold that originally was in Fort Knox and isn't there anymore, it was backed by death. It wasn't like we just walked off and found the gold on a piece of land no one was living on. We invaded and took it over because the resources were there. So the dollar's always been, all central currencies are backed by death. There's something you can really look at too. Real true statement. You know, actually, there was a statement, I think, once by Buckminster Fuller, and he says, if someone can't explain something to you in 35 words, they are deliberately obscuring it, or they don't know it. The more you understand something, the easier it becomes to simplify it so that you can communicate that understanding. And you have a tendency to do it through aphorisms, you know, small, short statements or pithy little statements and this kind of thing. And so the dollar has always been backed by death. But there's another really telling statistic that we can examine and know is true. There were no global wars before central banks came into existence.
That's exactly right. And what happened in 1911 when they went to Jekyll Island, they started engineering this. 1913, it passed. Then 14, yeah. We got World War I, and then the rest is history. But we have to take our one and only intermission, Cliff. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about Bitcoin. We have a lot of questions from members of our audience who want to know more about Bitcoin. As I said, I'm new at this, and at this point, I'm thinking, is it too late to get into this bandwagon? Has it already left, or is it going to continue going up?
No, it's so nascent. It is so young that if I had the strength, I would stand out there and just shout, Bitcoin, you dumb son of a bitch, Bitcoin. I mean, for years you'll be able to state that. And when we come back, and I can explain why.
And you have been saying this for years. I remember when you started, it was probably, you know, in the one digit, two digits, three digits.
It was, when I first started getting on to Bitcoin, when I knew for sure it was what I'd been looking for, I will say that I had been looking for a replacement for money, and I first thought it was e-gold. And then they came and they shut e-gold down. And so I knew we couldn't use a gold backed, and we'd had to arrive somewhere else. And then 4 years later in 2009, Nakamura's original paper came out, and I thought, aha, this is it. And then I waited. Because there was I didn't say anything because there was a birthing period, and that birth was delicate. It was fragile, and Bitcoin survived it. It survived the early attacks that strengthened its immune system, and it started to become robust. And then when Bitcoin had just passed the critical, in my mind, $3 threshold, that's when I started telling everybody Bitcoin, Bitcoin. And I didn't want to be too ferocious about it. I mean, I was shouting, but I didn't want to really scream about it because, again, I didn't want to alert too many people too early, but I wanted to get Bitcoin into a community that it otherwise would not. And I took credit for that. And that's, it's a failing on my part but I posted it out there and told everybody, look, you know, who else in the woo-woo world and the world of channelers and, you know, other spooky, strange things was telling you about Bitcoin way back when? None of these people knew because they're, you know, channeling and all that kind of stuff is bogus. And if you'd actually gotten in on Bitcoin at $3, when I was talking about it, well, where would you be today? It's gone several hundred times over that. So, and it's got yet several hundred times more to go.
That's incredible. And when we come back, just one last statement before we take the break. I'm just thinking, it's 100 years since the Fed came along. I remember, well, I wasn't alive back then, but Edward Bernays and his boys, they promoted the idea that the bankers at the time were corrupt and the people bought it, and that's why the Fed came along. Could Bitcoin, and I'll get your answer on the other side, could Bitcoin be a Trojan horse? And they could be planting this into people's minds so that we can fall into this trap. But when we get back, you'll tell us. How can people buy your reports, Cliff, and your website?
You can just go to the website, and you'll find a Bitcoin address there, and you send me a partial chunk of a Bitcoin, and I'll send you the report via email. Or if you want, you can use dollars for a while here and go through PayPal. Or send us something interesting, and we'll send you a report. If you send us something physical, you got to send an email address. We can email it to you, though. And I don't want anything alive. No food, please. Thank you very much.
That's funny.
But basically, we're in barter because the dollar is just so terrible. We've got people that are sending us, you know, goods they produce, and that is fair exchange. And we consider that to be an excellent fair exchange. We've had some very marvelous soaps come from people. Incense and clothing and this kind of thing, and it's a very fair exchange. And the dollars, it's less of an exchange because all I can do is stick them in a bank for the government to come and take them.
You know, a year or two ago, I've had so many people ask me, Mel, can you take Bitcoin? And I would just dismiss it as just woo-woo. I wonder if I had accepted all those Bitcoin subscriptions back then. But anyway,
it's never too late. Start now. Put that poster out there. Bitcoin accepted here.
Folks, don't go anywhere. This is such a fascinating interview, and we have so much more to discuss with Cliff High, the master behind the Webbot. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas on this fifth anniversary. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for listening to the first segment of this very important interview. To listen to the rest, go to veritasradio.com and subscribe. You will receive your login immediately. We'll take a short intermission, listen to some music, and we'll be right back. Enjoy.
This is Zechariah Sitchin, and you are listening to a wonderful radio interview conducted by Mel.